to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning today's program by previewing for you the next production of the Lakeside Players in downtown Kenosha, who perform at the Rohde Center for the Arts. And their next production, which opens this weekend and runs through the 10th of November, is the wonderful Mel Brooks musical Young Frankenstein, based on, of course, his hit 1974 comedy film. And we're going to be speaking today with Katie Gray, who has joined us on several previous occasions. She has, on a number of occasions, directed productions at the Rohde Center for the Arts and is the director of Young Frankenstein. And we also have with us Alex Ebert, who is portraying the really central role of Dr. Frederick Frankenstein, the grandson of the mad scientist. And we'll find out about all of the mayhem and foolishness that's going to be unfolding on the stage of the Rohde in this production of Young Frankenstein. Katie Gray, Alex Ebert, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Glad you can be here. And I know we are talking in the midst of what I'm sure is a frantically busy week. Katie Gray, how do things feel as opening night approaches?
Good, actually. There's still a lot to do, because there always is, literally leading up until the moment I think they take the stage. But overall, I think we're feeling good. We have most of our effects down and lighting and all that. So it's been fun this week.
Great. Did you have anything to do with the selection of this to be part of this current season of the Lakeside Players?
Yes. So I was actually on the play reading committee last year, and we selected this because we thought it would be perfect, obviously, for this time of year. It's a very funny show. It's a classic. And so, yeah, it was Alex was too. So we were both central in selecting it. And then we just kind of happened to I fell into the show. Alex auditioned for it, obviously.
Yeah. Tell me, Katie, and I'm interested, Alex, from you as well. When did you first become acquainted with this show? Have you seen it on stage, or do you just kind of know it through the cast album, or what's your experience with the show ahead of this production?
I had only seen the movie, and so I knew, of course, the classic Puttin' on the Ritz song from the movie, and obviously from, you know, Irving Berlin writing it. But yeah, I had never seen the actual musical before this.
Right. How about you, Alex?
Funny enough, I'm exactly the opposite. I have not ever actually seen the movie all the way through. I had somebody approach me like middle of last season and say that they had really wished that we would consider Young Frankenstein for a season. And I was like, huh. So I went home and I researched it. I looked it up on YouTube. There was like a good community theater recording of the production. And I watched it and I was like, oh yeah, this is hilarious. I think this should definitely be considered for our season.
Very good. And at that time, did you envision yourself as a potential Frederick Frankenstein?
While I was watching it, I definitely was like, oh yeah, I could see myself playing that role. Honestly, I was like, I don't know vocally if I could handle it, because it is quite a large vocal role. But I was like, I'm definitely going to throw my hat in the ring for it.
And here we are.
Yeah, it happened to work out.
Very good. So Katie Gray, I've sketched really nothing whatsoever about the plot at this point, except mentioning the grandson of the famous mad scientist. So outline for our listeners kind of the scope of the story of Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, so Victor von Frankenstein, who is, you know, the Frankenstein that you know, he dies, and Frederick Frankenstein, who does not want to be associated with the family name, is the only living relative. So he has to go to Transylvania and settle the grandfather's estate. And in the time, he meets, you know, the craziest people that you could meet, and decides, hey, I am going to actually build my own monster. And all the craziness that ensues from there. So it's very funny. The characters are hysterical. You have the classic. You have Igor, and not, you know, Igor, and he's probably one of my favorites in the show.
A lot of things get sort of turned on their heads.
Absolutely.
Can you say a little bit about why Frederick has this dramatic change of heart? And I mean, at first wanting to distance himself from his mad scientist grandfather, and the next thing you know, he's in the monster making business. How does that happen?
I think he doesn't understand his grandfather as much until he gets there and he meets everybody and he realizes, like, oh, I'm a lot more similar than I think I was. And so he realizes, you know, this is what he did. This is what I could do.
Hmm. So, Alex, tell us more about the character of Dr. Frederick Frankenstein. That is who you play in this production. Tell us more about him and about sort of the arc that he travels from beginning to the end of the show.
Yeah, for sure. So for those who are maybe coming to this show from the movie, Frederick is the Gene Wilder character from the movie. And in typical Gene Wilder fashion, it's a character that generally starts off very kind of, there's a good heart in there, and then as the story progresses, he becomes a little more unhinged, and then a little more unhinged, and by the end, I'm just full-on crazy. He definitely, I think in the beginning, he is only going off of, you know, the legend of Victor Frankenstein, and it is something that he's like, I don't want to be associated with crazy people. And then when he gets to Transylvania and he meets the crazy people, and it's just thing after thing after thing, and then eventually he's like, you know what? I actually think I could do this better than my grandfather. I think I can, because there are several times where I say in the show, like, oh, I'm going to do this, and if I do this thing that he didn't do, that it's going to turn out better. The monster's not going to be crazy. My monster's not going to be a monster. He's going to be a sophisticated gentleman.
Mm.
And then he just ends up being a monster. So
yes, plans do not go quite as they are plotted. That is for sure. It must be really fun to play a character like that who begins in one way, in a sense, kind of stiff and formal and sweet, sort of white bread, if you will, and then evolves into something quite different by the end.
Yeah, it's definitely new for me. So many of the roles that I have been cast in, I tend to be either the sweet or the kind of neurotic character. Whereas with Frankenstein, I get that moment of sweetness, but then by the end, I'm kind of the villain of the show, which is an experience I haven't gotten to have yet. And there are several lines where, like, I'm genuinely screaming at people on the stage, and it's a little bit cathartic.
Wow.
Yeah.
I should think. That's great. That's great. So, Katie Gray, tell us a little more about sort of the dimensions of the cast and how many characters in this story do we end up meeting in the musical Young Frankenstein?
So there are six leads. I always have to count. They are, of course, you have your kind of like ingenue characters. You have Inga, who is the lab assistant. And then you have Elizabeth, who is Frederick's fiance from New York. The monster, of course. And you have Frau Blücher, who is the housekeeper, who was also the former girlfriend of Victor. And then, of course, you have Igor, who is, like I said, by far probably, he's my favorite character.
Hmm.
It's hilarious. He's going to steal the show. And then you have Inspector Kemp, who is the hardline German soldier, who is sort of knows something's up because he's been attacked by one of Victor's monsters before. And then you have just like the ensemble cast, which is very fun. We have a really great actress who's playing the hermit, the blind hermit that kind of finds the monster. And then, of course, we have all of our other ensemble actors. So it's been really fun watching them all kind of gel together on stage, especially these last couple weeks when we finally got costumes and props and all that fun stuff.
Right. Tell us a little bit about putting this story on the stage in terms of the visuals that you wish to create. And you yourself made passing reference to some special effects and so on. I mean, that has to be a part of the challenge as well as delight of putting this on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, we have a lot of like kind of practical effects on the stage with lights and stuff that we're actually turning on. But we have a great lighting guy who is really kind of put together crazy lights to, you know, simulate the thunder and lightning and the craziness that's happening at the lab. We have some props we've never used before. So it's been fun. It's been an experience because I've not done a Halloween type show before. So trying to find like kind of the, you can kind of go out there, kind of find creepy props. I mean, it's a perfect time of year for it.
Right, for sure. Tell us a little more about the musical score. And we should mention that the words and the music and lyrics are by Mel Brooks, just as was the case in his even bigger hit, The Producers.
Yeah.
How would you describe this score?
I love it. There's always a song that gets stuck in my head. It's a different song and a different part of a song every day. I come home humming it. It's hysterical. It's a hysterical score. I mean, it's what you would expect from Mel Brooks writing music because the songs are just unhinged. A lot of them are. And then even the ones that are supposed to be sort of the sweet ones are, you're just like, oh, they've dropped that kind of innuendo in there. And, you know, you don't really notice it right away.
Right.
So I feel like every night someone goes, oh, that's what that means. And they're like, I've never gotten that before, you know, and they've listened to the song now for, I mean, a couple months.
Right.
And so they're like, oh, I've never really realized that. So I feel like if you've seen it or you know the music, you know, if you see it again, just because like the characters sometimes do like a motion and it makes them realize like what the song lyric means.
Right.
I think you can definitely get a lot out of it.
Mel Brooks likes to sneak things past you.
Oh, yes, he does. Right. Very much so.
So, Alex Ebert, you were saying that at the outset, as you thought about how fun this role would be, you wondered about how challenging it would be musically. How has that turned out to be for you?
Everything I thought it would be. it is. It not only is the music challenging, it's also extremely wordy, especially for Frederick. Frederick is in 14 of the songs. My first song in the whole show has a 32 measure. That's probably too much. I don't read music like that. But it's got this really big chunk where I'm basically just essentially rapping on like front center of the stage, and I have to memorize all these scientists' names in order and what they did. And then Frederick's notes go way up there. I think I have several times where I'm having to belt a note that's right at the very top of my register. And then like in Life, which is the song that occurs while we're bringing the creature to life, that is my biggest moment of becoming unhinged. Mm. So all of my lines are being delivered in this like screaming, growly, like commanding tone. And then I immediately have to switch into beautiful straight singing and then back into the growly tone and then back into the straight singing.
Wow.
So it's been an interesting and really fun challenge to try to navigate that. As a singer, I generally keep my voice very straight toned, very supported, very healthy. So this is a part of my voice that I've not really used, and it's been kind of cool to see. Like, in fact, on the way up here, I was just commenting to Katie that I'm very surprised at how well my voice has held up through this process.
I told him he could lose it on Monday.
Not until then. Right, exactly. You should probably acknowledge whoever is your music director for this production.
Yeah, so her name is Natalie Coogan, and she's been great. It's the first time she's worked as a music director at the Lakeside, and she's done phenomenal.
Great.
So she's kind of a double she's like a quadruple threat, but she's also helped out with the choreography, which has been really good because there's some very interesting dance numbers where you kind of have to make it up. And there's a fairly large tap number for putting on the Ritz.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Wow. A lot to enjoy in this show, that's for sure. So you open this coming weekend and you run through the 10th of November. And, of course, as we said, this is on the stage of the Rohde Center for the Arts. And, by the way, Alex, you mentioned that you have not seen the film. So even once you were cast, you still have not. Was that a deliberate choice on your part to not sit down and watch the whole film and Gene Wilder's performance?
Yes and no. We actually, as a cast, were going to sit down and watch the film. However, from my understanding, Disney has recently obtained the rights to the film, and they are doing some sort of revival or remake or something upcoming. So they have taken the film off of all streaming platforms.
Oh,
so
wow.
Unless you own a physical copy of the film, you can't watch it anywhere. And I just don't own a copy. So my intention was to watch it. I'm kind of glad that I haven't, because I know enough about it to be able to kind of emulate the spirit of Gene Wilder, but the one thing I did not want to be was a cookie cutter of Gene Wilder.
Sure.
And I'm afraid that if I had watched the movie, I would have just copied the Gene Wilderisms of it all, which I know people will probably come in expecting a very Gene Wilder performance, and I'm trying to put little bits of that in there, but I still want it to be my character at the end of the day.
Of course. I think that makes a lot of sense. By the way, what else would people have seen you in at the Rhodey Center for the Arts with the Lakeside Players?
Oh, gosh. I was the Cowardly Lion in the 2022 production of Wizard of Oz. I was Maurice in Beauty and the Beast. I was Princeton in Avenue Q. I was Horton in Seussical. I directed Blythe Spirit.
We're really trying to run them down.
Yeah. Basically, if you've been to the Rhodey in the last 2 years, you've probably seen me in something.
Yeah. And of course, people will have perhaps enjoyed Katie Gray's work as director of Rent, Little Shop of Horrors, and The Secret Garden, and now Young Frankenstein. That's quite an array of shows.
Yeah.
So good for you.
Thank you.
Shows your range. So if people want more information about tickets, what do they do?
They can go to rhodeycenter.org. So it's R-H-O-D-E, center spelled normal, .org, and they can purchase tickets there. I will say it is a 16 and up show because there are, like I said, some racy parts.
Mm.
So it is not for children.
Good to say. And the phone number there at the Rhodey is 262-671-8023.
Yes.
And again, the rhodeycenter.org, rhodeycenter.org, is the website where you can get information on ordering tickets for Young Frankenstein. Katie Gray is the director of the production. Alex Ebert is in the role of Dr. Frederick Frankenstein. Thanks to both of you in the midst of a busy week for joining me today on The Morning Show today. Great to talk with you.
Thank you
so much for having us.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper. Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their midst.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. And we are going to be spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show learning about a harrowing expedition that occurred in the early 1880s when a small group of American explorers sought to reach farther north, closer to the North Pole than any other human beings had ever reached at that point in time. We are talking about the Greely Polar Expedition, and we're talking about a book called Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greely Polar Expedition. As that subtitle suggests, this is an expedition that ended rather badly. And this account of what this expedition was like and the terrible challenges and conditions which these men faced is told in riveting fashion. And I so appreciate the great work of its author, Buddy Levy, who is the author of a number of different books that have explored various important figures in our history, including various expeditions somewhat similar to this. He is the author, for instance, of River of Darkness, Francisco Orellana's A Legendary Voyage of Death and Discovery Down the Amazon, and co-author of No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, and Geronimo, Leadership Strategies of an American Warrior. This book, published by St. Martin's Press, again is titled Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greeley Polar Expedition. And Buddy Levy, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
One of the first questions I want to ask you is to give us a sense of what was available to you in order to tell this amazing story in such meticulous detail. It's just incredible how much you are able to tell us about this expedition, which occurred back in the years 1881 to 1884. And I think most of us would assume that when a trip like that is undertaken, where there are just the matter of sheer survival is of utmost concern, that that little, if anything, would remain from such an expedition to be helpful to an author like you coming along, 140 years later. And obviously, you had considerable resources to which you could turn. Give us some sense of the legacy of this Greeley expedition, which could serve as the basis for your meticulously researched book.
Right. So I benefited greatly by Greeley's incredible thoroughness, and not so there. First of all, it was an army expedition, and Greeley as commander took great. It was an army expedition and a scientific expedition, first and foremost. And so Greeley spent a great deal of time each and every day recording everything from the weather patterns to which men were doing what in the command to the successes and failures of their journeys from the Fort Conger way up in the north. And so for 2 full years, they were taking, over 500 scientific readings a day. And a number of the men kept meticulous diaries, and a number of the men were writing not only personal diaries, letters back home, field notes, and at a certain point, not to give too much away too early, Greeley determines that they must strike from their comfortable fort, which is up near the top of Canada and Greenland, at a place on Ellesmere Island. And he is adamant that they take all of their records with them. They're boxed in crates, and so it was really the result of Greeley's great desire to have the record of their journey given to the world that I and other researchers before me have benefited from this wealth of literature. And so that's the primary sources are, letters, field notes, and then official reports written by Greeley and some of his other officers, which allow you to know on a daily basis, what the weather was like as they're either looking outside the fort, later a tent or some other crude structure they have cobbled out of the ground, and so that's really, really helpful and unusual, because in a lot of these polar expeditions, everything is lost.
Right. And fortunately, we have quite a lot to look at, and there are some photographs as well. So a photographer, right, obviously was along as well.
Right. So a gentleman named George Rice, a Canadian photographer, came along, and he's instrumental in this journey in a number of ways, but not the least of which is his remarkable photography. So I think in the book there are some 40 or 50 images, most of which are taken by George Rice. And again, they took great pains to carry these plates in secured crates and boxes along with them, which was really arduous, because they're having to pull these crates on sleds along, not only, with their diminishing food stores. And, Greeley is often wondering, and he asks the men, should we leave this stuff behind because it's a great burden? And they all agree that they need to take it with them.
This is an expedition which was undertaken in 1881. So this is at a point in time when I believe nobody has reached the North Pole, nobody has reached the South Pole, but explorers have probed very far south and very far north. And this particular mission, I believe, was a threefold mission, one of those purposes of this mission was to try to reach farther north than any other human being was known to have reached. So how far north had human beings gone before this? And so what were the Americans trying to achieve in that respect?
Right. Well, so, excuse me, that's really interesting because the farthest north element of the story was really Greeley's independent secret desire. And so you mentioned the three goals. So first and foremost, this journey was scientific, and it was part of this international, very visionary international consortium of a dozen research stations circumnavigating the polar regions all around the world. And Greeley's was the northernmost of all of these. So at the time they're dropped off at what they called Fort Conger, which was a 65-foot-long prefabbed wooden structure that they unloaded from the ship and then built there. They're the northernmost inhabitants in the world, actually. And so Greeley, knowing this, the other thing they were supposed to do was try to find any remnants or record of this USS Jeannette that had gone missing 2 years prior. And Greeley was supposed to look and see if he could figure out where these men were. He actually knew Captain DeLong. But knowing he was going to be this far north already, Greeley conspired to try to break this 300-year-old record of farthest north, which was just over 80 degrees north latitude at the time. And they're about 400 miles south of the North Pole, though, as you mentioned, no one had ever been there before. And what's really interesting to me is that there was a great deal of confusion about what it was like up there. In fact, there were some people who believed that once you broke through this ring of ice circumnavigating the North Pole, that it was actually a tropical open polar sea. And some previous voyages had gone up there, carrying, and they believed that there were palm trees. And Greeley harbored no such delusions. But at any rate, he was really hell-bent on trying. He was very patriotic and very nationalistic, and he was hell-bent on trying to break this record that had been held by British forays north. And so the minute he got up to Fort Conger, built the fort, and had everyone comfortably ensconced doing their science, he began to send out small teams of 2 to 3 men, usually Brainerd and Lockwood, two of his trusted men, and then a Greenlandic dog sled driver, and they would strike north.
One of the points you make about Lieutenant A.W. Greeley, who led this expedition and for whom it is named, is the fact that he had considerable experience, but very little, if any, experience when it came to specifically exploring the Arctic. And I believe, if I remember correctly, he also had no nautical experience. Tell us a bit more about what his background was, what he really was equipped to do, and then maybe a word about his shortcomings in terms of experience when it came to something as arduous as this particular expedition.
Right. So it's a great question, and it's one of the criticisms that Greeley sometimes receives and has received through history. So he enlisted in the Army when he was like 17 years old, and fought. He was a Civil War veteran, had been injured in the Civil War. He was a career Army man. He then ended up moving his way up the ranks and was a working for the Signal Corps and had been doing really great work setting up telegraph lines in the American Southwest. And he began to he was sort of fascinated with the polar north and expeditions and had read widely about them, and he learned of this expedition that was being conceived by this Austrian man named Karl Weyprecht, who he was the one who decided that it would be useful for the world to know more about the polar regions. And so Greeley managed to get himself chosen as the leader of this expedition. And you're right, it was they were in many ways ill-suited. They were not, it was not a naval operation. Most of the men had been under Greeley at the Signal Corps and in the Army, and they were on the plains on horseback just prior to embarking on this incredible voyage into these ice-choked seas. And McGreeley was a very, very quick learner. He was incredibly dutiful commander. You mentioned his shortcomings. He's a complicated figure in that as a career Army man, orders were paramount in his mind, and not following orders meant essentially chaos and mutiny. And so, you know, he ran an incredibly tight outfit, but he also, there was one thing that was interesting, it becomes interesting later, is that he had poor vision. So he's always mentioned in images, he's got obviously oval spectacles, and this becomes important as there, when you're moving through what are called leads, which are these sort of narrow highways of water snaking through ice-burdened seas, you really need to be able to stand in the front of a craft and see your way through. And at a certain point, you know, Greeley is, and one of the things I remark on is his ability to sort of shift his leadership style as necessary, because he realizes that his vision is an impediment, and that if he doesn't let someone else with better vision do the ice piloting, as it's called, that they're all going to be crushed by the ice and die. I really talk about his leadership style in a number of ways, because he makes some decisions along the way that become questioned not only by historians but by his men at the time, and it's fascinating to see him adapt.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we read here, besides kind of the matters of what ultimately becomes a desperate struggle just to survive, but also his struggle to maintain order, to deal with, in a sense, insurrection among certain key figures in this group. It is one thing to exert leadership and authority under sort of normal circumstances, but when one is many thousands of miles away from civilization, so to speak, leadership becomes a very different sort of challenge, and a very, very difficult challenge in many, many ways.
Right. And so I look at the expedition in sort of two main parts, which is their time at Fort Conger, when they have, you know, this incredibly comfortable double-walled fort with outbuildings that are serving as their scientific base. They've got a coal seam up there. They've got, you know, heat. They can heat this building. And they're confronted with, you know, wolf attacks, and they endure 100-mile-an-hour winds and -100-degree temperatures. But they have the fort, and they're also contending with this thing called the Long Night, which is the polar darkness that descends around October 15th at that latitude, and then the sun doesn't rise again until February 15th. So you've got this psychological burden of darkness and cabin fever, and Greeley is amazing at he creates a kind of school where he's teaching mathematics and science and meteorology, and he's giving lectures, and he has the men competing in foot races and snowshoe races and shooting competitions under the flaring aurora borealis. And then the second part is when he makes the very momentous decision to leave Fort Conger at per his instructions and orders, which creates some division among the men. And then they have to strike 250 miles south to where they believe the rescue or resupply will come, because and that's been preordained. And so then that part, then it becomes a matter of survival, and they're out exposed on ice floes, and they for months they're moving southward, and really has to really change his approach at a certain point, where he decides to have meetings with the officers and men who've been, you know, surfacing as great leaders, and then ask their opinions and actually have a kind of democratic approach to whatever they're going to do, because each decision at this point means their lives.
We're speaking with Buddy Levy and talking about his new book, Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greeley Polar Expedition. I don't think we've yet really spelled out the dire straits in which this expedition finds itself at a point in time when things begin to go drastically wrong, thanks mostly to Mother Nature. Explain, at least in brief, what goes wrong with the expedition and what puts these men in such grave peril.
Right. So, well, as they're moving south from Fort Conger to this area that they're meant to reach called Cape Sabine, at this point they've got a steamship which is only 28 feet long, and they're towing a number of whale boats, and they're moving through this wind-swept and wavy body of water that if you fall into, if you're there for a minute or so, you're going to die. And then what happens is all the ice is ever moving, and so they're having to lift all of their stuff periodically up onto these ice floes and icebergs. And at one point they're stranded on an iceberg that is actually being crushed by other icebergs, and they're on it for weeks and weeks, and they've got dwindling food stores. So Greeley has to take an account of their rations and determine how long they can live on diminished rations. And then when they finally manage to reach Cape Sabine, they come to realize that all of these rescue efforts and resupplies that were meant to leave things for them, for one reason or another that they don't know yet, have failed to reach them. And now they're stranded on a barren shore with very little food and virtually no shelter, and they have to figure out how to live until the following spring. And they arrive there in the late fall, and the light is about to go out.
It's impossible to even imagine what it would be like to be confronted by circumstances so terribly grim. And of course, much of your book chronicles exactly that, what it is like to be attempting to survive something that would seem to be a completely hopeless situation. One thing we have not yet mentioned is the fact that this book is not only a chronicle of Greeley and his men on this expedition, but is also a chronicle of what is going on back home, because this is an expedition that is generating news headlines, and it is also, of course, a point of enormous concern for one Henrietta Greeley. Tell our listeners about her, who she was, and the role that she plays in this story.
Right. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because Henrietta Greeley, so Greeley had met her while he was working the Signal Corps in San Diego, and she was an affluent woman, the daughter of a banker. And so she was not really that thrilled when Greeley decided to head off on this expedition, because everyone knew, Greeley and Henrietta were both very well read, and they knew that crew losses of polar expeditions were averaged 50%. So it was not, the odds weren't that great. But she is in, once the resupply ships fail to get to him, and she learns this because they're under the aegis of the U.S. Army, she begins this effort, really tireless effort, to create a kind of national interest in her husband's expedition and the fact that the U.S. government is responsible for them and needs to act. And so she is just tireless in her efforts to write to and have her brother, who is connected to U.S. newspapers across the country, create this these editorials saying that, that something needs to happen. And she works at this and works at this until finally, you know, even going so far as to write letters to the President of the United States, to Robert Todd Lincoln, who is Abraham M. Lincoln's eldest son, who is the Secretary of War, so that in the end they can't drag their feet any longer, because the Secretary of War was not very keen on polar expeditions in the first place. Ultimately, you have a naval expedition that is launched with assistance from the British Admiralty, who offer a ship, and you get this other. So I bounce back and forth between the man stranded on an iceberg and then the halls of Congress where they're arguing about whether to go, what to do, and it creates a kind of tension, and then cut to Lady Henrietta Greeley, who is working every day to try to make sure something happens. And I think it's kind of riveting to move back and forth between these happenings.
Absolutely. Well, to have this sense that back home, they are in no position to know exactly what is going on with the Greeley expedition. And of course, we know, but they don't know, or they don't know exactly or precisely what is going on, what has befallen this expedition. And of course, one can also appreciate the fact that when one sends a rescue expedition of any kind, you are placing those men in the path of great peril as well. I mean, it is something that should not be done lightly. I mean, what a difficult situation for everyone involved.
Right, and the other thing that I found really compelling is that once these rescue missions are dispatched, you've got Greeley and his men literally clinging to an iceberg that's being reduced by other icebergs bashing into it, and then ships that are moving northward from Newfoundland and up through the Labrador Sea and the Cane Basin trying to get to them, and neither of which knows where the other are, but you have this really, really great system of correspondence that they used back then. They called sort of Arctic post offices. So they would leave, they'd build rock cairns at different places on islands on prominent points, and they would leave written messages under these cairns. And so you've got Greeley and his men discovering certain things about where caches of food are supposed to be, and then the rescue missions trying to find out more information or any information about Greeley's whereabouts. And at some points, these they get very tantalizingly close to one another, and then there are shipwrecks that occur within the rescue missions, as you mentioned, and so you've got men scattered in different places, and it becomes just this harrowing fight for life by all involved.
Right. And of course, it's always important for us to remember that we're talking about 1882, 1883, 1884, and the technology available at that time, which was next to nothing when it comes to matters of exploring in such dangerous environments. It reminds us that it's sort of amazing that any human being would make such an attempt in the first place. And it's really equally amazing that anybody would follow in their footsteps, not knowing what kind of peril they were going to be confronting.
But really, I look at it very much akin to space exploration. You know, they were going places that were very, it was the unknown, you know, and it was about discovery. And so I really think that's what they're driven by, not only the national pride of some arbitrary record, but by, you know, Greeley and his men discovered places or went to places that had never before been stepped on by humans. And so it's a little bit like landing on the moon, you know. And so I really, I was also just moved by that desire to find out what's beyond. And then, you know, of course, the ability to survive in these elements that make us realize now with all of our comforts and down and Gore-Tex that maybe these people were just tougher than we are.
Well, we're going to leave it to our listeners to find out the final fate of the expedition by reading your book. I will say this much. Some people do survive. To what extent was this a huge story at the time? And what ultimately was the public reaction to the Greeley expedition?
Right. Well, let me say a couple of things. One, it was an enormous story, and making world headlines, without saying too much, there's an amazing rescue, and some of the men return national and even global heroes, but I wanted to add that. You know, the subtitle, The Triumphant and Tragic Polar Expedition, there's a great deal of humanity in this story, too. There's patriotism, there's heroism, there's men doing selfless acts of endurance for the group that I think we can learn a lot from. And so it's not only a sort of sensational foray into tragedy, but it's really about how people can work together under very trying circumstances and figure out ways to help one another, even, you know, at their own peril. So I just wanted to add that.
It's an astonishing story. And again, I'm amazed that there is so much available to you in order to tell this story in such remarkable detail. The book again is called it's called Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greeley Polar Expedition, published by St. Martin's Press. And the author, Buddy Levy. Buddy Levy, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for giving the world such a fantastic book.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of Dr. Art Sear, a member of the faculty at Carthage College, joining us for his monthly visit to offer his analysis of current events and issues. On Friday, part one of a two-part interview I was privileged to record with one of the most highly regarded contemporary composers of opera and musical theater, Ricky Ian Gordon, who's written a remarkable memoir called Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera. Part one of our interview airs on Friday. Part two will air on Monday. Next Tuesday, you'll hear a recently recorded interview with William Cope Moyers, son of Bill Moyers, and one of the most familiar voices when it comes to matters related to addiction and recovery. He is coming to southeastern Wisconsin the first weekend in November for a special event. We talk on Tuesday about his new memoir called Broken Open. And next Wednesday, a week from today, Herschel Kruger from the theater faculty at Carthage talks about a new work that's being done there called Life Cycle of a Star. And the playwright, Ali Viterbi, will join us as well. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today, we should have skies becoming mostly sunny, and we'll have a high temperature close to seasonal norms of 60 degrees. Clear overnight, but chilly, an overnight low of 37 degrees. Both Thursday and Friday, there is a chance of some showers and thunderstorms. Right now, the extended forecast calls for sunshine over the weekend and daytime highs in the low 60s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.